Today on the show, we are joined by Tia Angelos, who is the founder of Smart Women Society, and we are answering your questions. We'll be looking at how to work out whether to stay or go, how do you find a coach or mentor, and do you wait for long service leave at the cost of some of your sanity? Let's get into it. This is a podcast about making work work. You'll learn about leadership, career growth, and how to navigate those weird work challenges. I run a HR consulting business called Boldside, where I help leaders build epic team cultures. If you lead a team or run a business and you think I can help, let's connect on LinkedIn. My name is Shelley Johnson, and this is Work.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, Tia, welcome back to the show. It's so good to be chatting with you.
Thank you so much for having me back. I'm excited to do another episode together.
So we have collated a whole bunch of listener questions for today, and I'm going to hit you with them, and we're just going to bounce off each other because there's so many good questions here that I'm sure a lot of people have experienced. And the first one, just to jump straight in, the first one is from Glynis. How do you suggest to an employer that a new role is the solution rather than adding new responsibilities to an existing employee's role?
Oh, this is such a good question. And I honestly feel like it happens all the time. We always get questions saying, my boss wants me to do more things. We need to hire more people. And my biggest recommendation that I always say is, get out a sheet of paper, get out a Word document, and I want you to list in one column all of the role responsibilities or the role description of the existing role. So list everything out that is the current responsibilities of the role, and then make a second column on the same page and write out a list of all the additional activities, the additional responsibilities that your employer is looking to add to the existing role. And then with those additional things, put and specify a time allocation against each one of how long it would take a week to complete all that additional work. And I want you to then show this document to your employer and clearly communicate to them that the existing role doesn't really have capacity for those additional things. And having it all written out in a document with two columns makes it so clear to them that we actually do need to hire another person to do this stuff.
It's such a tricky conversation too, because when we talk with our boss about our capacity, we feel like it reflects badly on us, like we're not doing enough or we're not delivering the core responsibilities. But I think when you put it down on paper and you actually like have that kind of data to support what you're trying to get across, it can be really helpful. As well, what it can do, like there's a couple of options here, and we see this all the time in HR where, you know, things happen in the business, you know, there's budget constraints, there's all these different dynamics. And we look at a role and we go, okay, well, could we reimagine and rethink how this role actually operates? And I think that a lot of the time when we're working in a role, we've been working it for a long time, we just assume that we have to continue doing certain tasks, that like that's a non-negotiable. But sitting down and talking with your manager about, okay, here's all the things right now that you want me to be able to achieve that I can't achieve, and I think there's an opportunity for us to hire someone new, but also have up your sleeve the discussion of, or are there things that actually we could stop doing? Because I think this is another dynamic, and we run this thing with our clients to help them navigate this particular concern where you look at a role and you look at the tasks in your job and you say, double down on, deprioritize and delete. And so there's like three categories. So if you're working through this and your manager comes back and they say, well, no, we don't have budget to hire another role, so we just need to figure it out, then we have to have the next conversation off our sleeve to go, okay, well, if you're communicating that we just have to continue as is, we need to rethink what I'm doing in this role because at the moment it's not sustainable. Like I'm trying to do two full-time roles and that's just not feasible. So can we do this activity and go, what are we going to double down on? What are we going to deprioritize and what are we going to delete? Because often we assume that the stuff in our role is a non-negotiable, when really if you have that conversation, you can go, wait, this thing that I've been doing for the last like 18 months, does that actually add any value?
Exactly. And I think as well, there's a lot of fear around having these kind of conversations with your manager or your boss, and the fear of seeming like you're not wanting to step up or not wanting to take on more responsibilities in the hope of a promotion or a pay rise. But the other thing to remember is your manager doesn't know everything that you do every day. They don't know how long it takes to complete a lot of your core tasks. So really stepping that out with them and having the discussion of what's important, what's not important, how much can you fit into your work week, I think is really healthy and productive.
And it just gives you tools to actually say, I'm not coming at this conversation as a blocker. Like, I've got ideas for solutions, but I need to let you know that at the moment this workload isn't achievable and the quality will drop. And I think if you have that language, like sometimes managers are more motivated by what they're going to lose than by what they're going to gain from something. So if you were to talk to them about, okay, if we continue as is down this current path and we don't hire anyone new, here's the impact of that. Like, the quality of this particular task will drop because I can't physically do that and get that much work done. And like, show them what they're going to lose. Have you heard of Dr. Robert Cialdini? I think is how you pronounce his last name's work on the ways to influence people.
Oh, I haven't. Tell me about it.
Well, he's this American psychologist. It's pretty old. Like, I think it's in the like 80s. So it's like pretty old, but he talks about six ways to influence people. And one of the ways is scarcity. So this idea that one of the fastest ways to influence people is talking about what they'll lose rather than what they'll gain from something. So if, let's say, like, I'll use a really like easy example, like in HR, when I'm influencing a manager, if I say to them, hey, if you do these things and change this behavior, you'll get a really nice, healthy culture and everyone will be happy. They're like, oh, yeah, that sounds good. But if I say, if you don't change, you're going to lose your top performers and your whole team's performance will drop. They're like, oh, crap, I've got to change quickly. Yeah. So we're more motivated by what we'll lose than what we'll gain. So when you're communicating with your manager, talk to them about not, hey, if we add another person, we'll be able to do all this amazing stuff. Talk to them about if we don't add another person, the quality is going to drop.
Exactly. It's a bit deceptive, but it works.
Well, yeah, you can look at it. I think you can look at influence in two ways. You can say it's deceptive, or you can see influence as manipulative, or you can see it as movement. Like, influence can be, I'm moving someone to take action and the right action, or it's manipulative.
And what's it going to take to get to that right action?
Exactly. So it's all about that communication. But what's your take on that as you're hearing that? Because I do think you're right. Like, sometimes it can feel manipulative.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's the fundamentals of marketing. It's the fundamentals of any kind of persuasion to lead with problems and lead with, well, here's the problem that we're identifying and then here's the solution. So I definitely think people are motivated more by fear and scarcity than positive outcomes. So yeah, definitely a way to approach it, especially if your manager's a little bit more difficult to work with. And another thing I had a thought of before, which is what my first mentor ever taught me when I started work, was never come to your boss or your manager just with a problem. Always come to them with solutions and with options. And I think that's the perfect answer to this as well, that don't just go to your boss and say, there's too much work, I can't manage it. Take them solutions of, well, this is how we could hire someone else. This is how we could decrease some of the unnecessary tasks in my current role, and always come with solutions and options so they feel not cornered, but that they have the opportunity to select the best path forward.
Oh, you're so right. I have heard so many managers say, oh, my team just keep bringing me problems and there's no solutions. Yeah.
Stuck with me for so many years now, like, never just come with a problem.
Totally. And I like what you're saying as well, not just a solution, but options.
Because then they feel in control of the outcome, even though you've kind of positioned them in the way that either option is beneficial to you, but giving them the option makes them feel like they've had control over the situation, and then it's a positive outcome for everyone.
And would you, if you're kind of preparing for that, because I love this whole, like, this is almost like a process. So you write down in column A, all the things that you currently do, all the actual additional activities, then you might come with like two or three options. And would you suggest, Tia, that we have a recommendation? Like, here's the three options, but I would recommend we do this.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the recommendation is kind of a subtle nudge of what you would prefer. But essentially, as we've kind of discussed, is having the option of, well, here's column A of what I currently do. Here's column B of all the additional things. Option A is, do we need to hire someone else? Option B is, do we need to look at column one and delete some of these things that aren't that necessary to add in some of the additional activities, and kind of workshopping it with your manager. So it looks like it's a team collaborative effort, but you've really kind of position them in the way of what you would prefer. Like, it might be that you want to get rid of some of the annoying administrative tasks that you have to do every week, or it might be that you just really need a new person in your team. But yeah, having those options, pushing a recommendation and making it feel like your manager's in control, I think is the best way to approach this question, but also a lot of situations I feel that we have at work.
Totally. I think we can apply it to so many different examples. And I love what you're saying about giving them that sense of agency. So you're not cornering them, you're presenting options. And if you feel like, oh, well, is that manipulative? I think it's movement. It's getting someone to take a step.
So combining the fear aspect and the scarcity aspect with the options, I think is the best way that you're actually going to have positive outcome out of this. Because I know a lot of the time with this kind of scenario, you kind of present it and then nothing happens and you just end up absorbing it because it needs to get done. But yeah, I think having really clear communication, really clear options, and option A, option B, how we're going to move forward, I think is actually, yeah, really going to move the needle forward and have impact.
All right. Daniel has asked, should you wait for long service leave at the cost of some of your sanity? Tia, what do you think?
This makes me laugh a little bit. I guess the first thing, without knowing the insights into Daniel's brain, is how long until you actually qualify for your long service leave? Is it a couple of years away? Is it 3 months away? I think that's the first question that would kind of influence my answer to this. And then from that, like understanding the time period, is really understanding what is the cost to your sanity. If it is only 3 or 6 months away, can you essentially manage or suck it up for the next few months to really hit that gold pot, the jackpot at the end of that period? Or is it something that is really bogging you down and you're like, I can't do this, I need to look elsewhere and find my way out? So yeah, I think it's weighing up that time horizon as well as what is the actual cost to your sanity. Is it a real deep impact on your mental health, and is that seeping into your other areas of your life? Or is it just annoying coworkers that you've just had enough of because you've been there for so long, but you can suck it up for a bit longer?
It's so funny that you say that, because I do, my immediate thing was like, wait, Daniel, tell us exactly the details. Like, I need to know, like, in numbers, how many days do you have left? Because like, can you put the calendar up on your fridge and just cross them out like a tally? Like, I'm just imagining in prison.
And put your long service leave number on the fridge that you're like, what can I put photos around it of what you're going to do with your long service leave? Are you going to go on a big overseas trip? And yeah,
get,
I think you've got to weigh it up. Yeah.
I'm just envisioning Daniel tallying it up like in prison. That's what the days, but it definitely depends on how long it is, because, and what you're experiencing in that environment, because I have seen people stay in toxic environments. And I think the tendency is we stay way longer than we realize, and the impact on us is so much greater than we realize. So it's kind of those two dynamics of, you've got this golden, it's almost like golden handcuffs down, it's the, like you said, the golden like pot. And really, what is that worth to us? Because essentially, if you're saying, to Daniel's point, at the cost of my sanity, I go to straight away the cost of your mental health. Like, if you're feeling really anxious every day, if you're driving to work on Monday morning, and I know like a lot of listeners have talked about this, where they're driving to work and they're feeling really emotional, they're feeling really anxious or nauseous, or
you're always on edge at work, and yeah, it's not nice.
It's not nice. And I kind of think the cost of that feels really high to me. And I think, well, 2 months off is awesome. 8 weeks off is amazing. But also what we know, and I saw this, I can't remember, I think it was in the Daily Oz, but like somewhere they were talking about the research of, if you change jobs regularly, you increase your income more quickly than if you stay in the one job. So I also think, what is it costing you financially if you stay for 2 more years just purely to get that 8 weeks, and you're miserable and you're like driving to work and you're teary on Monday morning? Like, what does that cost? Because it's very difficult to equate versus I get 8 weeks off.
Exactly. And think about the broader impact on, if you have a partner, a relationship, what's the impact on that? What's the impact on your family and your friends? Are you not being able to show up in other areas of your life because you're so miserable at work? I think the conversation around the cost of your sanity, the cost of a toxic workplace, doesn't just stop at you being at work every day. It really seeps out into all different areas of life. And that's a huge impact that your work can really have, because we spend so much of our week at work that you really want to enjoy the hours outside of work. And if you find that you can't even do that anymore, I think it's definitely time to have a wake up call and realize that maybe you do need some change.
And I think your distinction between, I think your call out about the cost on your relationships is massive, because it's so huge, but so difficult to quantify that impact. And I've worked in environments where I've been really miserable, and my husband, Sam, who is amazing, I feel like I've had nothing left to give my family, who are the most important people in my life, where I've gone.
And it's so unfair on them.
It is unfair. Like, they get their like dregs of
exhausted,
like,
depleted version of you.
and that's the thing. I'm like, am I prepared to pay that cost? And that's what you have to really ask yourself, Daniel. Like, are you willing to pay that cost? And anyone, I think a lot of people have been in this spot where, you know, if you're in Victoria, I know it's like 7 years you get access, and I think you get access pro rata at 5 years. So like,
yeah, I think it depends on the company as well.
Yes. It's good to know the legislation, because if you know and you're like, well, I could get access to it pro rata at 5 years, rather than just thinking, oh, I have to wait to 7 years or 10 years, whatever it is. Even just knowing that can help you go, well, you know what? I could get pro rata like 4 weeks or whatever it is. That's still something, and you're not losing your sanity in the process, as Daniel mentioned. Is there anything else that you think people need to weigh up when they're considering staying long-term at a business like this? Because like, I know some people, Tia, have things in their mind. Like, I've had metrics in my mind sometimes, like, I just need to get to 2 years, or I just need to stick it out to like 5 years for my resume or whatever. Do you like have any advice for anyone who has these kind of measures or metrics that they're working towards in their mind and they're weighing up these big decisions?
I definitely think that it is more of an old school way of thinking, like, I need to be here for X number of years, or I'm going to be seen as I'm moving around too much, or I was a failure at this company. But I always lead with the approach of a toxic workplace is never worth it. It is absolutely never worth the impact on your mental health, the impact on your physical health, because it definitely impacts your physical health. When I've worked in a toxic workplace before, I would have chronic migraines from the stress of just being miserable in the office. So I always say that, yeah, a toxic workplace is never worth it, no matter the number of years you need on your resume. And I've been finding more and more that hiring managers, recruiters are less bothered by a shorter stint at a company if you can justify it, and justify it in a way that doesn't seem like you're attacking the employer or you didn't give it a good chance, but really, yeah, putting it in perspective and being able to say that this environment wasn't for me and I'm looking for a new opportunity. So yeah, I definitely think you don't always have to have metrics in your mind. And I think, yeah, more people are lenient and flexible with that in the current job market.
There is that tweet that I'm thinking of as you were talking there about the toxic work environment, that is, a toxic culture will change you more than you'll change it.
Absolutely. And it's just easier to get out.
I think we always need to have in our mind, like, what are my non-negotiables when it comes to work? Like, I feel like I'm much more aware of that now and see it in people where maybe their non-negotiables, they allow those things to be deprioritized because they're afraid of taking a risk with their career. They're afraid of kind of stepping out. And so they slowly over time water it down. So maybe one of your non-negotiables at work is, I want to work in a place where everyone is kind to one another, where they speak with kindness.
And those places do exist. I think some people as well kind of convince themselves that all workplaces are like this, or all teams are like this, so I just need to suck it up and get used to it. But there are good workplaces out there. There are supportive managers out there. There are workplaces where you don't have to feel scared to walk in every day of what people are saying behind your back. So yeah, don't convince yourself or become accustomed to a certain behavior because you think that's what everywhere is like.
That is an amazing call out, because we start to normalize the behavior and think, oh, this must just be everywhere. And you're 100% right.
That's just how work is. Yeah.
Yeah. And I can't tell you how many amazing, amazing organizations and leaders I've worked with where I'm like, sign me up. How do I work for you? Like, I love the culture here. It's just that when we experience the negative of it, we feel like, oh, okay, like this must just be the reality.
Absolutely.
So think about, Daniel, your non-negotiables. I'd encourage you to kind of write them down. Think about, what are the non-negotiables for me? What are my must-haves when it comes to work? And then work backwards from there to go, are these things being met? And if they're consistently not being met over an extended period, well, it's time to rethink it. But to Tia's point, if it's just annoying colleagues and you're like, you know what, this is not a deal breaker. Like, sometimes people
I can rise above it.
Yeah, I can look at the mood board of my holiday and go, yeah, nah, it's worth it to deal with this person who eats really loudly at their desk.
Or the tuna eater in the kitchen. That seems to be the common complaint.
Yes, tuna. A tuna eater for sure. Not not for me. Okay, next question. D says, staying at your job for the flexibility of your kids and the pay versus leaving for your sanity. We're getting a few sanity questions in here, Tia.
Yeah, and I think the themes and the concepts are going to be similar across this one as well.
Yeah, so I'm just going to elaborate, because D's actually said here, I actually get bullied by one staff member who's friends with everyone. It seems like a no-brainer, but the flexibility for my kids really weighs me down and is what's keeping me here.
That's a tricky one. And I think first and foremost, bullying is never okay. In no scenario, no situation is it okay. As I said before, we spend so much of our time at work. So you really shouldn't be working somewhere where you're scared to go into the office. You're scared to bump into this person. You're scared of what they're saying behind your back. And I think more and more in the current job market, especially post-COVID, flexibility has become more and more common in a lot of roles. So it's hard without knowing your industry and the role that you're in, D, but I would recommend looking elsewhere. I think there's definitely a lot of flexible work options and flexible roles out there. I do not think you should stay somewhere where you're pretty much scared of this one staff member and what they can do to you. And obviously there are the traditional routes of going to management, going to HR to flag what's happening, but if you really think that the scenario is that this bullying can't be stopped, even if there's formal intervention, which sometimes can make situations worse, I definitely think look elsewhere, because there is a lot of flexibility and a lot of companies really embrace it now, especially for working mums. So yeah, don't feel like you need to be miserable in your role and targeted by this one person, because you really need that flexibility for your kids.
I was talking this week with a HR manager and we were discussing this thing of bullying and what happens when there's bullying in workplaces. And you're 100% right. We should never tolerate it. It is absolutely unacceptable and not a behavior that you should ever have to put up with. I was having this conversation with this HR manager, and one of the things we were talking about is what happens when employees don't speak up. Because sometimes, like, we assume, I think, managers know. And there's cases where they absolutely should know and act without anyone having to say it. But sometimes it can be very hidden or like concealed or under the whatever I'm trying to say, surface, whatever that metaphor is. And
especially as well when it looks like, as you said, D said that the staff member's also friends with everyone else. So there's obviously this kind of rhetoric that, oh, they're loved by everyone, but then why are they targeting me? Do you know what I mean?
Exactly. And bullying is really insidious. So I really empathize with Dee, because it's such an awful, painful thing to deal with. And me and this HR manager were talking about what we can do in HR and in leadership roles to make sure people feel safe to bring up their concerns. So that's obviously the role of a leader. They need to create an environment where people can speak up and share things that they're afraid to share. And on the flip side, I think employees, it's really, really important in my mind that you do speak up and that you have the opportunity to say, this is my experience, this is what's happening. And because I think every organization needs to hear directly from employees when there's this behavior happening. And so I know it's like, I agree with what you said, Tia, that sometimes it can make it worse. But I also know from the other side, like even just having this conversation with another HR team member recently, that so many HR teams want to hear this stuff, but they don't hear it until the exit interview. And yeah. So don't wait to the exit interview. I would encourage you to, if you're like, start those options of considering, you know, what's next. But also I would be saying to you, be brave and speak up, because you actually don't know who else this is happening to either. And that tends to be the case with bullying. Like we think that it's solely us, but like bullies also
and
have
it's such an isolating experience.
It's such an isolating experience. And that's, it's awful. And there's like gaslighting and there's all these different dynamics that get involved in that. We start thinking, oh, it must just be me, when really chances are there's a pattern of this behavior within the workplace. And we tend to see that where, you know, your one brave act of raising this could benefit so many different people, Dee. And I know that's terrifying and like scary and all those things. But if it was me and I was the HR manager in this business, I would be desperately wanting to hear your story. And maybe there is ignorance on part of the organization that they're not aware, but it could also just be that it's very insidious and under the surface. And so my encouragement to anyone who's experienced this would be brave. Like, can you be brave? And what would that look like? And maybe like think that through, talk to, if they have an employee assistance program, talk to someone who knows the business to get insight, talk to a mentor to get insight into your particular situation. Obviously we don't know all the details, but I do think that it's just interesting having this conversation recently about how do HR and leaders create an environment where people can speak up safely and feel secure enough to do that. So we'd call that psychological safety, but also how do we help you, Dee, be brave? And if you're going to leave anyway, I think that being able to speak up before you exit might have benefit for a lot of other people in that business as well.
And I think to add to your point as well, Shelley, is that don't downplay your feelings and don't downplay the situation because you think it's very high school. And I think a lot of people think that bullying stops once you leave school, which isn't the case at all. So don't be ashamed that this is happening and it shouldn't be happening with the age that we're at and that we're in our big jobs and big corporates or big offices or whatever it might be. Don't be nervous that you're bringing this to the forefront because, as you said, Shelley, like HR managers, leaders, managers, they want to create a psychologically safe environment and a work environment where everyone feels supported and encouraged to bring their best self to work and their most authentic selves to work. So yeah, don't downplay what you're feeling and the situation that you're in because you think it's childish or not important or you might be overthinking it or whatever it might be.
There's a great episode we did like quite a while back, Dee, with Jess Hickman on bullying at work. So she's an expert in how did you deal with bullying at work. So I'd encourage you scroll back. It's quite a long time ago. Scroll back. She's also got some amazing resources on LinkedIn that you could use to actually start a conversation. She calls it upstander leadership, where you're able to speak up in really difficult circumstances. And her story, she's got her own personal story of dealing with bullying. It's a really helpful dialogue and conversation. So go listen to that. Anyone else who's resonating with this and they think, oh, I'm dealing with this in my workplace, make sure you check out that episode and go and find Jess Hickman on LinkedIn. All right, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we've got a couple more questions on finding a coach and mentor and making a decision between staying or going in a particular job. If you want to grow in your career, I just wanted to remind you about our book, Sort Your Career Out and Make More Money. Glenn James and I have written this book to help you with any kind of career crisis, but also those things that you want, like getting a promotion, making more money, moving into a leadership role, or if it's time to quit your job. You can find our book wherever you get good books from, or you can listen on the audiobook, Sort Your Career Out and Make More Money. Now let's get back to the show.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
All right, Georgia has asked, is it better to stay in a job that pays well but has a long commute, or take a job closer to home but it's a $20,000 pay cut? What do you think?
I was saying these types of questions. There's never a right or a wrong answer. I can't say to you, Georgia, option A is the best or option B is the best. In these scenarios, I think the best thing that you can do is break down both options and weigh them up against your goals, your values, and the stage of life that you're in. So to start off with, a $20,000 pay cut has a pretty big impact on your personal financial situation. So before making any decision that would cut your salary by that much, I would recommend that you create a budget based on your actual income at the moment, expenses, savings, with your current salary, and then do that same activity and make a budget with the reduced salary and see what impacts that's going to have on your finances. So have a think about, what are your financial goals? Do you want to save for a house deposit? How much will that impact saving for the house deposit? Will it mean that you can't buy something for another 2 or 3 years? So think about what the impact is financially. Can you still meet your essential needs with the new salary? Will you still have money left over to put towards your goals, any fun things? And will you still be able to enjoy your life with the new salary? So I think that's the first thing to weigh up, the financial impact. And then on the flip side of that, also have a think about and write down all the things that you're gaining from not having to commute such a long distance every day. So quantify it as much as you can so you can understand what the change means. This could be an extra 2 hours a day that you could spend with your partner, with your kids, with your family. It might mean that you could go to the gym 3 times a week because now you can go to a Pilates class in the morning. Or it could give you extra time at the end of the day to unwind and just relax. So try and quantify it as much as possible what the impact of a shorter commute is. And then lastly, for both options, think about the longer term outlook of the job. So is there opportunity to grow in the new role? Is there opportunity to achieve the same or more salary as your previous role? Think about how long it would take to work back up to your original salary. So yeah, definitely weigh up everything and consider all those different aspects. And yeah, I think it's a personal decision dependent on where you're at in your life, what your goals are and what your values are.
I love what you said about thinking about the long-term trajectory of the new role, because I think often when we're confronted with this type of decision, we're thinking really in the immediate terms. So this is, and it goes back to what we said before, we're more motivated by what we lose than by what we gain. So when George is weighing this up, she's looking at, well, I'm going to lose 20K. And that's like, I love what you're saying about thinking about, well, what could you gain? Because if you're moving from this role where maybe you don't have a lot of career progression, but you're paid really well right now, versus you take a pay cut, but over time you could actually increase your salary by 50 grand because there's way more career progression opportunities. So like this whole concept of thinking in immediate terms and only thinking about what you lose has drawbacks, as well as like it helps you influence someone when you're trying to get them to move towards an outcome. But when you're only thinking about what you'll lose versus what you gain, it impacts the quality of the decision making.
Absolutely. And I think a lot of the time when people do make a call on a new job, and they always think of, what is the immediate impact on my life right now? And that's why I added in that whole longer term outlook, because you do need to weigh up, like, is there a career progression path in this role? Is there a way that I can earn more money long term in this role? And I think that influences your decision in the now, knowing what your work and your job is going to look like in 6 months, 12 months, 24 months. So it's important to consider both the immediate impact and what that impact is in the future.
And I think also thinking back to what you've also said, Tia, about options. So think about maybe there's 3 options here. We're thinking about this as like a either or decision. I either have the commute plus 20K or don't have a commute and don't have the 20K. But like, what about I talk to my existing employer about more flexibility? are there more days to work from home? Now, I'm making the assumption that you've already done that. You probably have had that conversation, Georgia. But let's say you haven't. I think we've got an episode coming out fairly soon about flexibility and how you can have conversations to create more flexibility, because we're seeing employers push now to get more people back into the office, which has been a big challenge for a lot of employees. So I want you to think this through of like, have I actually had all the conversations that I could have with my existing employer around, hey, is it possible to do 3 days from home and 2 days in the office, and discuss that and make sure you're having those conversations before you make any of the big decisions.
Absolutely. And I think as well, weighing up, as I mentioned, your values, like, do you value a shorter commute time because that means you can spend more time with your family or your partner? Or do you, and this could be in the short term or the long term, do you value more money so you can put that towards your financial goals? And there's no right or wrong answer, and it's so individual and personal to every single person, but definitely consider what your values are and what you want to prioritize. And I think that will also impact your decision.
All right. So last question. And this is one, Tia, this comes up for us so much. Like, I reckon every time I put a call out of listener questions to our community, we get this exact question. And I think it's really interesting because I'm going to put it to you because I don't know that I can think of the answers off the top of my head. So Annie says, how do I find a coach or a mentor?
Yeah, this is a popular question. And I think that there's a few answers to it. And I would say that before you start searching for a coach or for a mentor, have a think about what you're trying to get out of it. So a couple of things to think through is, are you looking for a coach for motivation or for accountability? Are you looking for a coach to learn more leadership skills or for personal development? Are you wanting a mentor that can give you guidance on a career pathway that's specific to your industry? So firstly, have a think about like what you want to actually gain from this person. And I think that will guide you towards more a coach or more a mentor. And there's a lot of amazing people that you can find through LinkedIn, through social media, that offer coaching services more focused towards that motivation, accountability, personal development style of engagement. And I think just having a research, seeing the specific niche that you need help with. And yeah, there's heaps of social media pages that you can find the right coach. LinkedIn, I feel like they're popping up everywhere. I think the trickier one is finding a mentor, and finding a mentor that may be more tailored to your career. And there's a couple of options of doing that. So firstly is try looking internally at your company for a mentor. If you're doing that, I would suggest not having a mentor that sits directly in your management line. I think a mentor should be able to provide independent guidance to you, but still having an understanding of your roles and responsibilities. I found that one of my mentors, that's still a mentor to me now, quite a few many years later, and I met her through a volunteering thing that was at my office, and she was in a completely different team. She understood the company and understood my role, but she was quite removed from what I was doing, and she could give me the best insight and the best advice. So I would definitely recommend trying to find someone that isn't your manager, isn't your boss, because they've got a vested interest in the advice that they give you, but finding someone that's a little bit removed that can kind of give you that impartial, independent guidance that you need. And then alternatively, I also recommend, I'm a big fan of cold call and a LinkedIn cold message. So I always recommend searching LinkedIn for people that might have experience or a career path that you're really interested in learning from, and sending them a message, telling them that you admire their career journey, and asking them if they want to have a 30-minute Zoom call or a coffee chat if you live in the same city. And you'd be surprised how generous people are with their time, especially if they want to help people with their career progression. So yeah, I'm a massive advocate for a cold message. Don't be scared to send it. The worst thing that can happen is that they don't reply and you just move on with your day.
I think that's really good, the distinction between the coach and the mentoring, because I think mentoring can be that longer term, like you described, of that relationship you had with someone from your old work that's continued on to this day. The other thing, Emily Bowen, who used to host the pod, she used to talk about this idea of mentoring moments, and I really liked that, because sometimes we think like to have a mentor, we have to go all in, and it's like a marriage where you're like all in with one person for an extended period. where she liked to look at it as, I have these people in my world and I might have some mentoring moments with them. It could be only one kind of interaction where I'm getting mentored by someone based on their experience. And that might be it. Or it could be an ongoing relationship, like the more kind of formal or what we think of mentoring when we think about that kind of traditional model. But for me, I really liked that. And to your point about the LinkedIn message, I would say you start small. Like, I've had people message me saying, oh, would you consider doing mentoring? And I'm like, I don't even know you. So that's a really big commitment, like for anyone. So I would be like exactly what you said, like 30 minute coffee catch up or something, like start small. Think about it. Like if you think about dating, you're not going to ask someone to get married on the first date. You're not going to ask someone to mentor you ongoing in the first interaction. Like it's a slow burn. So like build it up as a slow burn and find out. Yeah, there has to be chemistry, I think, in a mentoring relationship, and you have to be able to trust that they're credible and all these things. So start small, be generous. Like if you're going to ask someone to mentor you and invest time, be generous, like shout them lunch, like do something or send them some kind of like thank you gift if you get something out of it. I think that to me, I guess, and in a previous episode, Glenn said, don't be a taker. And that's my mindset. Like if you're in this relationship with someone where you're getting so much gold out of it, just don't be a taker would be my closing
remarks.
Absolutely.
I could not agree more. And I think as well with any form of networking, not just mentorship, always the question that should always be in your forefront is how can I help? How can I give back to this person? Because if you're always taking, people see through that quite quickly and realize that you're just there to get as much information out of them as possible. But I find that every single person, no matter how junior you are, no matter what industry you're in, you always have something of value to share with other people. And I know a lot of our community is a lot younger and they're always asking, like, what can I give to someone more senior? And you'd be surprised how much senior leadership people want to learn about the younger generation and how younger people think. And I always think that there's something that every single person can share and give value to another person. So yeah, always come into a conversation of how can I also help the other person, not just take up 30 minutes of their time out of their busy schedule.
Totally. Got to be a win-win. That's what I think with any kind of relationship. I think with all of this stuff, Tia, it's being like prepared. And I love what you do at Smart Women Society because you talk a lot about the thinking that happens beforehand, because any of these kind of interactions are all about kind of having the conversation and as you say, shooting a shot. Like, so you're putting yourself out there on LinkedIn to say, can you be my mentor? Or you're having a difficult conversation with HR or with your manager, or you're asking for more flexibility, whatever that is. There is this sense of like nervousness or apprehension to ask for help or ask for what you need. So do the preparation, and that's what you help people do so well. It's the thinking that happens beforehand that sets you up for success. Like you said, writing the two columns of like writing down what's happening in your role. How can people follow you? Because I know you just have so many great resources for people to help them navigate all of this stuff we've just talked about today.
So if you want to explore more of our SWS resources, head to our website, smartwomensociety.com. We have heaps of different game plans and tools that you can check out. Follow us on Instagram at Smart Women Society. And you can also follow me on LinkedIn as well. I do post, and I'm trying to post more often, Tia Angelos on LinkedIn.
Awesome. Well, if you enjoyed this episode, message Tia or follow her on LinkedIn or Smart Women Society. So much great content all the time. I'm always like reading up and just loving what you're putting out there, Tia. And Tia's book, Smart Moves, such a good read. It is amazing. We'll put all the links in the show notes so that you can make sure you're getting all the goodness from Tia. I just want to say thank you so much for coming back on the show. It's been such a pleasure to talk to you today.
Thank you so, so much for having me, Shelley. I had a blast. And I hope the answers have helped all the listeners that submitted them.
All right. If you enjoyed this episode, give us a 5-star rating on Spotify or Apple. Helps us get the pod out there and share it with a friend. Thanks heaps.
We acknowledge the traditional custodians of the lands on which we live and work and pay respects to their elders past, present and emerging. We extend that respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples who may listen to this podcast.
Before you do anything meaningful with your money, you need to be able to control your money. I can help. The Glen James Spending Plan is a complete spending plan budgeting system that will show you how to manage your money. It includes a downloadable spreadsheet that will tell you how much to put into what account each week and you will get control over your money within 2 pay cycles. Thousands of people have used the Glen James Spending Plan and it is now free. So download the Glen James Spending Plan and enroll today.
Hey, welcome to the Next Wave podcast. Consider us your chief AI officer in your business. My name is Matt Wolf. I have the number one YouTube channel in the AI space. I also run FutureTools.com, and I'm joined by my co-host, Nathan Lands, founder of Lore.com. We want to bring you the latest AI news and trends, show you how you can use AI in your business and personal life, and help make it super easy for you to understand and execute. We're going to equip you with the knowledge to thrive in this upcoming wave of change.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.